244-9455 is the number. 217 is the area code. And we have some volunteers who have been very generous, given up part of their morning to talk with you. It will take a minute or two, and you will come away with the good feeling that comes with knowing that you are a supporter of the station. If it's time to renew your membership, maybe you signed on for the first time last year, that would be great. And of course, we have people who have very loyally supported us year after year, and to them, we want to say thanks. But to everybody else, if you've been listening for however long and you're not a contributor, now is the time for you to make a contribution. You could do that at the $40 level, which is the basic level, or more if you can. That's up to you. The important thing is that we can count you as a supporter of the station. 244-9455. Also, you can do it online if you like. We have a new pledge address this time around. It's willpledge.org. It's a secure site, and you can go there and you make your financial contribution. And it's really important today. In particular, we have a challenge going. We've heard from a supporter of Focus 580, a couple, in fact, who said they'll add $25 to every pledge we receive during Focus up to 10. So that will increase our pledge total that much more. But we've got to do it just during Focus 580. So that means we have just until 11:55 to do that. And of course, also that, as we have mentioned earlier, we've been mentioning all through the morning, that our friends at World Harvest Foods want to encourage people to support WILO. And they say that if you will sign on today as a new friend, now this is only for people who have never contributed before, but if that's true for you, if you call in with a contribution, we will pass along with our thanks and their thanks, a $10 gift certificate courtesy of the folks at World Harvest Foods, because they want to encourage listeners to become supporters with that incentive. So if you've never made a pledge, 217-244-9455, make your pledge now. It'll help us meet the challenge. You'll get that gift certificate, and we will appreciate it very much. Well, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about movies, and our guest for the program is Murray Pomerantz. He's a film scholar from Canada. He is a sociologist by his academic training. He's chair of the Department of Sociology at Ryerson University in Toronto, and he's also a faculty member of the Joint Graduate Program in Communication and Culture of Ryerson and York University. He's written a lot about film. He's written about American cinema of the 50s. He's written about Alfred Hitchcock and his work. He's written about Jerry Lewis. He has written about images of boyhood and girlhood in film and many other things, too. His most recent book is about the work of Johnny Depp, and the title of that book is Johnny Depp Starts Here. It is published by Rutgers University Press. That's out. And questions, comments, as we talk about film, are certainly welcome here on the show. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Thank you very much.
Hi, David.
For being here. Tell me about what interests you about Johnny Depp. Why an entire book on him?
Yeah, I had a dream that I was in a bookstore, and all the books in the bookstore were about Johnny Depp. So I thought I'd better write a book about Johnny Depp very quickly. And then some friends of mine encouraged me and said, you know, you could write a good book on Johnny Depp. Why don't you do it? So I started, and there's the book. It happened. I'm fascinated by Johnny Depp, and I think really most viewers are. There's something intensive and very, very elusive about his presentation on screen. And he has, of course, established a career where he has become so many different kinds of things on screen. It's almost like a chameleon.
Yeah, it's interesting. In the book, you in talking about him, you make comparisons between him and many other actors, some of them real screen icons.
Yeah, like Bogart and Brando, for example. Monty Clift, yeah. My point is that he's not like any of them. And in fact, nobody's like Johnny Depp.
Last week, I had the opportunity to talk with Tab Hunter.
Did you really?
I didn't get to meet him. It was a phone conversation we had with
him.
How
is Tab Hunter?
He seems to be doing fine. He seemed like a very nice man. He's 74 years old and is living well and comfortably, I think. And he has just published a memoir because he was encouraged to do this, I think, by some friends of his who said, you know, somebody else is going to write this book and you might as well do it first.
Yeah.
So you can say, okay, this is me. I'm saying this is what it was all about. We had a nice conversation, and we talked a little bit, among other things, about his being one of the last stars to be under exclusive contract to a studio and what that was like. Nowadays, as people know, movie stars, they can work for anybody who will employ them. But at that time, and this was sort of at the tail end of the studio era when he was in his golden boy years, things were different. And here, and I do have a point, as Ellen DeGeneres would say, the connection with Johnny Depp is at one point in the conversation I said to him, so tell me some actors now today who interest you. And he named two people. He named Renee Zellweger and he named Johnny Depp. And I thought that was pretty interesting. And when you think about two actors who are in their image are very different, come out of two completely different kinds of Hollywoods, you couldn't hardly find two guys that were more polar opposites than Tab
Hunter and Johnny Depp. Yeah. For listeners who are too young to remember, Tab Hunter was sort of the ultimate Apollo screen figure. He was blonde and blue-eyed and very muscular and tall and stockily built and gorgeous and suntanned all the time. And he always played characters who were exactly like that.
Yeah, exactly.
And Johnny Depp has not played that one character. I think that's the one thing he's never been on screen, actually, is the blonde. I'm sure it's coming, but he's never been the blonde Apollo. He's much more Dionysiac, and he's much more changeable. And I think that's what he has in common with Zellweger. Probably that sense that you'll never quite understand how you're going to find them in the next character they do. You know, it's not, Zellweger's not, say, Nicole Kidman or Gwyneth Paltrow, where you're always going to see Kidman and Paltrow through the character. With Zellweger, she's going to actually disappear. And Depp, in a way, gives the illusion of disappearing. But what I find fascinating about him is that he actually doesn't quite disappear, but he also doesn't appear. So it's neither quite fully. And He's always changing, always moving through the screen space in a way that that we find exciting and challenging.
Yeah.
Something about his eyes.
Yeah. Just, I guess the thing that I was thinking of is sort of setting up this difference between, you know, what are the qualities that make a movie star, and I suppose that might be there are movie stars and there are actors. And there are some people who are both and some people who are only one or the other. What are really the big differences between people who are the big important figures of today and people of, say, Hollywood's golden era? I mean, what really are the important differences between Tab Hunter and Johnny Depp?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Look, there was a famous anthropologist who decided to go visit Hollywood around 1948-49 named Hortense Powdermaker. She wrote a book called Hollywood, the Dream Factory that was published in Boston in 1950, and it became a more or less archetypical study of the Hollywood movie industry. And it's still in print and it's still around, though a lot of people put it to the side. I think it's an interesting book. Mm-hmm. She argues in that book that what you had to have to be a star was some kind of characteristic that could be fixed upon. And it could be almost anything. You could have a funny nose. You could have high cheeks like, say, Jack Palance. You could have, you know, super-duper blonde hair and blue eyes like Tab Hunter. You could have a deep voice, a husky voice like Lauren Bacall, you know. It could be almost anything. You could have the eyes that didn't match the mouth like Humphrey Bogart. You know, all of these guys have something. But whatever it is, you can market, you can attach, you can advertise on the basis of, you can characterize out of this little aspect of the personality. So the traditional Hollywood star always had this kind of thing. I found the comment from Hunter interesting because the old guys who were studio stars, they were fastened on to by the studio brass and they were turned into stars by the studio process using some fixation on this characteristic that was something you could build on. It was like the foundation of a building, if you like. So the studio stars were made that way and they lived under the studio contract. So, you know, as long as they basically behaved, you know, you could say as long as they watched their ass, they were in good shape, and they were in good shape for 7 years, and then it could be renewed. They didn't really have to worry very much, except they had to do what they were told to do. You're going to do this picture, now you're going to do that picture. You know, if they were smart, they didn't get too invested in any of the pictures, so they didn't worry too much about what they hated and what they loved. They just did it, and they just made the money, and their careers grew. After the 1980s, when stars became freelance, intensively freelance as they are now, they have to watch their front, not their back. You know, you don't have to watch what you do. You have to watch who's looking out for you and make your next buck. So you're continually marketing yourself. And everything you do, every move you make, is an advertisement for the future and the ability to make more moves later. I think it must be a much more terrifying business to be a movie star today.
Hmm. His story, we talked a little bit about his childhood. He was a shy kind of a shy, lost boy. And when he was a kid, particularly when he was a teenager, one of the things that he apparently loved almost more than anything else in the world were horses. He loved to ride horses. And he grew up, did some of his growing up in Southern California, and hung out at stable because he loved the horses. And there was an actor who hung out there too that saw him, and I guess he thought that this, you know, this boy was impossibly beautiful, and that's what you look for to make movie stars. So in a sense, Tab Hunter was mucking out stables when he was discovered, which is a great story. It's not quite true, but it's close. And one of the things I said to him was, well, do people talk about discovering people anymore? Does that happen? Are people discovered like they were, or is it that that there's a long line of people outside the studio? They're banging on the door and wanting to be let in.
Much more that. It doesn't mean that people aren't discovered, but there are agents and parents and representatives putting people up all the time, and the people who are making movies are essentially at a 24-hour smorgasbord. You know, they're just sitting there with files in front of them and pictures in front of them when they're casting, and there's a continual search for the person that's going to be the right one to fit into the picture in this way. Who are you going to test for this role?
We got a caller here. I want to bring him into the conversation in Indiana. Line number 4, toll-free line, right here. Hello.
Hello. This is another one of those ones where I wish I didn't have a question because everything's been said is so interesting, but here goes. The thing you talked about, that anthropologists finding things in particulars about certain actors and actresses, you know, I've seen that, and I guess that's part of it. I find for myself that I really enjoy, actually I collect movies from the 30s and 40s, basically. And thank God for DVDs and for outfits.
Absolutely.
Outfits who sort
what
of
what
like,
did we do before DVDs existed?
We had VHS, but, yeah. You know, at $29.99 a clip.
Right.
You know, so thank God for Turner Classic Movies.
Except that he colorized things, yeah.
Yeah, well, I guess they're getting away from that. Anyway, now there's outfits, you know, there's one in Pennsylvania, Alpha Video, which does an incredible amount of stuff from the periods I'm interested in. And sometimes they're not the best copies, but there may not be a best copy as far as that goes. But I zoom in on them a lot. I'm a lover of character actors myself. Frank Jinks just came to my mind when you talked about you know, noses and eyes and things. And there's certain little thing to their voices that I find that I like, both male and female, that makes me want to have all their movies if I can find them. And though I, you know, the stars are stars, I understand that, and after seeing a high school play, then seeing someone from Hollywood doing acting, you know, there's definitely a difference, you know. There's something going on there that I haven't pinned down, but undoubtedly even people who are not well-known who act are, you know, incredibly better actors and actresses than what you might find in your civic playhouse and stuff, though there's good people there, too. This is a roundabout way to get to the question, which I hope you can give some insight in, and that's not really a deep one, but I'm often wondering about the copyright laws. I called up a fellow and I said, hey, did you know that there's a Boston TV station comes on in the middle of your film and shows its logo and stuff? I said, isn't that illegal? He said, well, yeah, in a way, but if you don't copy the big-time boys, they don't get on your case about it. And I said, well, okay, you know, I'm getting a film cheap that I wanted that I couldn't find anywhere else in any format. So that didn't bother me. But I have noticed a lot of things with Alpha Video. They have a tendency to clip off the beginning, so you don't know if PRC did the movie or Tiffany or Monogram or who, unless they usually show something at the end or that you can find it in some reference book. And that upsets me a lot. Because I like the Poverty Row people myself. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering if you could just say something.
Well, something very small, though. You've actually said something else that, sir, that kind of intrigued me. But I would, just off the top of my head, not knowing much about the company in Pennsylvania you're talking about, but it sounds to me like they're either pirating or borderline pirating to some degree, because I think if they had, in fact, signed legal arrangements, I think you'd be getting everything there was to get. So I'm not saying that that you shouldn't continue to collect what you're collecting, but I'm saying it does sound to me like some papers didn't get signed somewhere with lawyers in the room.
Yeah.
But, you know, can I just quickly comment on the seeing the high school plays and then seeing the movies and the acting difference? Because I think that's really intriguing. It raises the whole distinction between stage acting and screen acting. Whether the stage acting is at the high school play level or even at the Royal Shakespeare Company level on the one side, and then what you can see when you watch a movie like, for instance, Swing Time with Fred Astaire, would that do as a 30s movie?
Sure.
When you're looking at the film, you have something in play that is never in play in the theater, and that's the action of the camera. You know, very often these guys who make movies wouldn't very well stand up on stage, actually. They don't know how to move. They don't have a voice. They don't carry. In fact, I saw a play in New York about 6 months ago that had three stars in it, all of whom were from Hollywood, and two of them really held the stage and one of them didn't. And it was very interesting to see how, you know, there's stage training and there's not stage training going on in Hollywood acting. So the camera can come in. You can get a medium shot or you can get a close shot of a face, you know, with Bogart or with Astaire. You know, with Astaire, when you get a kind of full body shot, but you don't get anything else. So you just see the dancing. You see literally from the tips of his toes to the top of his head on screen. So as long as he's in control of the motion, you know, there's a tremendous sense of presence on the screen. When he's talking, you can get a medium shot or a close shot of his face, and his eyes, his eye movement can seem to be magnified on screen. So it really seems like terrific acting. If that were being done on a stage, it would seem like nothing. So the techniques of stage acting and the techniques of screen acting are quite different. And I think that was a really radical transformation for people altogether in the 1910s and 20s when they started watching a lot of movies and had been watching a lot of theater, to actually learn how to appreciate the kinds of things you could see on screen. Must have been a really exciting adventure. For us, of course, we just take it all for granted.
Yeah, I guess it would split for me that there's people who know how to move those facial muscles just the right way for the close-up camera or the medium shot. Then there's people on stage who know how to project back to the upper seat.
Well, that's exactly it. Go. In fact, for screen acting, very often you succeed at it by doing nothing.
Yeah.
Let the camera do it to you, so it's passive. You know, allow something to be done on your body by the camera. Just sit there.
Can I carry this a little further, David?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Well, because I'm still plugging away at the. I'm not really concerned about the. Everybody's making a lot of money out of these films, the VHS and DVDs, who's ever producing or stealing or whatever. But I've noticed there are times, like on Turner Classic Movies, something would show up, an early monogram, for example, and I just presume Turner bought the things, but I don't know for sure one way or the other. Then some of the Poverty Row places, like Chesterfield, Invincible, and Allied Artists, but it's not the ones we normally think of. Are those? Do you know if those are just sort of left out there? Nobody does the copyright, and nobody buys them.
I don't really have the answer to that question. Yeah. I think with Ted Turner, he actually does, in fact, collect. He has a library, so he's adding to his library, and he screens stuff that's from his library. Yeah. I mean, when you're trying to make a lot of money and you're in the business, what you want to do is own all the properties that you're using.
Yeah.
You know, so I would think with Turner Broadcasting. He's actually collected, bought up for his own stock, the reserves of a lot of studios.
Yeah. Okay.
But with other broadcasters, I think sometimes they just contract out for the license rights to do a show.
Yeah. I connected with a fellow that does, he takes a VHS, turns him into DVD as a business, and he has collectors throughout the world is how he explained it to me. He didn't tell me a lot, but he said, I just run down people who have prints, and then I run them off. He says, Nobody owns, the copyright to them because it was, died years ago. So you just find collectors who are willing to take a small amount of money for use of their tape and turn it into DVD. But I was just wondering along those lines. Thanks a lot. I want to get off and listen to more.
It's been
thanks
nice talking to you.
All right, thank you. We're talking this morning in this part of Focus 580 with Murray Pomerantz. He's written a lot about film. He is a Canadian scholar. He's a sociologist by his training. He chairs the Department of Sociology at Ryerson University in Toronto and is also a member of the faculty of the Joint Graduate Program in Communication and Culture of York University and Ryerson, and has written about many different things about movies. movies. His most recent is the book about Johnny Depp I mentioned at the beginning of the show. He's here visiting the campus. His visit is sponsored by the Unit for Cinema Studies and the Illinois Program for Research in the Humanities. He'll be giving a talk this afternoon at 4 o'clock. It's free and open to the public. This was at the auditorium of the Program for Research in the Humanities. What are you going to be talking about?
Johnny Depp. The talk is called Depp, actually.
About Johnny Depp. So if you're in and around Champaign-Urbana, you are welcome to attend, I think. Anybody?
Great.
Should feel welcome. And also questions, comments here on the program are welcome, too.
Well, I think I should say, if you have 30 seconds to plug the book, I always want to plug the book, if I can. This is the first time that anybody has written a serious book about Johnny Depp. There are four or five books out there, all biographies. You know, he was born here, and then he, you know, he had this girlfriend and that girlfriend, and then he fell in here and did this movie. And this book actually wants to look at the screen surface and talk about what he's presenting to us. So,
yeah, it is a serious scholarly work,
but fun to read. I hope.
Yes, it's. I wouldn't want people to get the idea that somehow it would be only for college professors or only for people who are in cinema studies. But it's also not. It's not a People magazine kind of a deal. It's a more serious thing than that.
Okay.
All right. Let's take a second here to check in with Dave Teal. He is the station manager at WILL-TV. He is in Pledge Central. That is the place where the volunteers are waiting to hear from people who want to call in and make a contribution. 244-9455 is the number. Dave, I want to make sure that we mention again the challenge we have talked a little about here. We're trying to encourage people to call in. And how are we doing on that challenge?
Well, first, I just want to mention you gave me a promotion there. I'm the program director.
I'm sorry. Oh, Carl. Listen, there are days when Carl would probably be happy if you want to take over as
yeah,
station
sure,
manager.
Sure, but
yes,
you know.
Carl Caldwell, he's the station manager. Dave Teal is the program director.
I just felt I need to mention it, especially in case Carl was listening.
Yes, Carl's listening. Okay. Yeah. Sorry, Carl. We weren't meaning to nudge you out of your job.
Well, we have gotten several calls in during Focus now. I think we've got three in, and we'd like to hear from at least seven more during this hour because we have a challenge for $250. This is from a couple in Champaign. They will add $25 to each pledge during Focus this morning, up to a total of 10. So that's $250 on the line. We've had three people call in and take advantage of that. There's an additional challenge right now from Bert Gray of Decatur. This is for 10 new members. If you have not contributed before to the Friends of WILL, 10 new members, he will add $20 to each new membership to a total of $200. So $450 on the line. Now, we have not gotten any new members. The three people who called in, I think, have been either current or previous members of the Friends. So we really want to retire the one challenge before this hour ends. We've got about a half hour to do it. And the other one, we've got a little bit longer, but we still want to get going on that. One other quick thing. If you are a new friend, you have never contributed before, we can send you this morning a $10 gift certificate courtesy of World Harvest Foods. They want to encourage listeners to become supporters. And if you've never made a contribution before, call 217-244-9455 and become a friend, get that $10 gift certificate, and get in on both of those challenges.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
We'll check with you again at the end of the hour and talk some more here with Murray Pomerantz. Questions welcome, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll free 800-222-9455. One of the other things that had this really nice conversation with Tab Hunter, as I say, he was a really nice man. One of the things that I asked him about and didn't really get a very good answer on, and maybe it's because it's not an easy question to answer, is I asked him about, we're talking a little bit about screen, the idea of screen presence, that some actors really have it and some don't. And there are some in between. And I'd sort of ask them a question like, well, what do you think that's about? I mean, what is it about some actors that they really do hold the screen? And when they're there, you watch. And
Jimmy Dean comes to mind. We should invoke Jimmy Dean because he died almost 50 years ago now, right? It was the 28th of September 50 years ago that he died. And his film came out 2 days later. So it's time to remember him for a moment. Now, this guy he only made three films, and he had the most astonishing screen presence. You couldn't take your eyes off him.
Yeah.
I think it was partly that he was an interesting-looking guy, but that wasn't it. It was It was that there was something raw and real about each moment he allowed to happen in front of the camera. He didn't put anything on. It was just there. He just was himself. And I say that realizing it's an extremely ironic and almost silly thing to say actors are never themselves, but there was something existentially very raw and simple about his moments. One of the really great Jimmy Dean moments is in Rebel Without a Cause when he comes home one night, the night of the Chicky run, he comes home after having been part of a teenage escapade in which one of his colleagues gets killed. And he's a wreck. He goes into the kitchen and brings out a bottle of milk. They used to have milk, everybody, in glass bottles. Brings out a bottle of milk, and he's wearing a red jacket, and he leans up against the kitchen door, and he's got this big, fat bottle of milk, and he puts it up against his forehead and just rolls it around a little bit. It's a great moment. You know? Yeah. Nobody else could have got away with that. Yeah. So, you know, that's a description of a moment of screen presence. What the screen presence is very hard to put a finger on. It's never the same thing twice, I think. It's a magnetism. It's something which is seductive for the viewer, something that's not very clear, something that's repeatable in a certain way. There's a certain kind of rhythmic quality to it, so there might be a twitch or there might be a look that can go over and over again. I was watching Agnes Moorehead on television this morning. She had a kind of way of looking to the side and dropping her mouth, which was kind of like, oh, God, it's all hopeless, that kind of look, you know. Yeah. She would just do that. She does it in all of her pictures, and there's something extremely provocative about it. And you wonder, well, what's so hopeless? Why are you doing that? I mean, what is it that you're giving us? Some kind of rich transcription of the human feeling, maybe, is what we could call it. Huh. It's a little bit like having a radio voice. You know, someone will say to you, David, you got a great voice for radio. And, you know, you're just on the air, you're just talking, you do what you do. Yeah. What is it in your voice that's a great voice for radio? Or what is it in a model's facial structure that makes her great for cover shots? You know, is it that she looks slender? No, there are lots of slender people who don't work. You know, mm-hmm. That the light bounces off her in a good way? Yeah, well, a little bit. But there's also something there that we've never seen before. So with Johnny Depp, it's a combination of an intensity of gaze, a tremendous tranquility of posture. He is absolutely physically at poise and relaxed at each moment, no matter what's going on, almost as though he's a sculpture. So there's something of the Greek sculpture in him. There's something of the lost boy, which is slowly now getting eroded away as he's playing these middle-aged characters, but it's still a little bit there. I wouldn't say that he's sexy. He's not sexy exactly. He's magnetic, but it goes way beyond being sexy. I'm sure he turned some people on sexually, but I don't think that's the root of where the international audience is gravitating from. Mm. I think there's something much more ethereal than that.
Mm. Is he big internationally?
Yeah.
Yeah? Or around the world, he's a popular star?
Yeah, more than ever before. I don't know to what extent he's popular in Asia. I know the pictures are selling there.
We have somebody in a nearby community here, Belgium. Let's talk with them.
Belgium, everybody. Illinois?
Belgium, Illinois. That's right.
Yep.
Yeah, here we go. Line 4. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Yeah, you were talking about James Dean.
I was.
Yes.
And I think he would have to put Steve McQueen in that category.
Well, you could. He's not up there with James Dean, but he's definitely something to watch. Yeah,
he doesn't hide anything either.
You know,
kind of like.
You think so?
Yeah.
Steve McQueen.
I'm not talking about the blob.
No. I'm thinking of, say, Bullet, one of his great movies.
Yeah. Bullet. What was the one where he was a sailor? This was set
Sand Pebbles.
Sand Pebbles. Yeah.
The Sand Pebbles. Yeah.
Steve McQueen was always thinking, and so he was hiding his thoughts. And James Dean wasn't thinking; he was being. And there's a difference. I would agree with you that McQueen was one of the great screen actors. One of the great screen actors. The heist one, the Thomas Crown Affair. Now, that's a movie everybody should see. Get rid of the Pierce
Brosnan.
The original
Brosnan. One.
Get
yeah.
rid of
Forget
the Pierce Brosnan.
Brosnan.
Just throw it away.
Yeah. The one with Faye Dunaway.
Faye Dunaway.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Unbelievable.
What was the World War II one?
Great Escape.
Great Escape, yeah.
McQueen always had something going on behind the eyes there.
Yeah, yeah.
Especially in Bullet. You could just see him. Every time his eyes shifted a little or twitched to the side, you knew that he was thinking about something.
Yeah, and his use of facial muscles from the time, I don't know, he didn't smile too much, it seems like.
Yeah, that's right. And when he did smile, it was high-value smile, right? Because you didn't get many of them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, that's all I want to comment on.
Thanks for bringing his name up. Great moment in Bullet where he goes to dinner with, sorry I'm going to blank on this, but there's the main female star, and they go to a restaurant, a little Italian restaurant, I think. And there's a smiling moment there. Yeah.
Not all that long ago, I saw for, I don't know how many times now I have seen The Magnificent Seven, and someone was talking about the fact that during the filming that there was this tension going on between him and Yul Brynner, because Yul Brynner thought he was the star, and it just ticked him off that Steve McQueen was always doing something to get the attention of the viewer. There, particularly, there's, you know, the scene in the beginning where they're going to drive the hearse up to Boot Hill. Him and Brynner. So Brynner's sitting there, and he's got the reins. And there's one point what Steve McQueen does. Somebody hands him a shotgun. He breaks the shotgun open. He pulls out one of the shells. He puts it up to his ear and shakes it. And he was doing stuff like that, and it just ticked off Brynner no end, because he was saying, "Dude, you know, this is my movie. I'm the star. Quit doing stuff to distract me. You're distracting me." I like that. I like that story. And he seems to be such a smooth, easy presence through that movie. And the two of them really not. You know, they work really nicely together.
Well, you have the feeling with Steve McQueen that he's listening to a jazz riff when he's acting. Miles Davis, maybe.
Yeah. Just, you know. Very good. Let's talk with somebody else here. We have a listener in Effingham.
Effingham?
Effingham, Illinois.
I'm learning the names of all these towns as well. It's great.
Line number one, go ahead.
Yes, I would like your guest's thoughts about the actor Robert Ryan, whom I hold in high regard.
Yeah. There's something... angry and seething about that man on screen. I'm not really talking about any of these people the way they actually are in life, you know. I mean, I think we all know that. It's the screen image. Yeah, it's very clear in Crossfire. He just boiling over with something.
Would you put him, as far as his stature as an actor, would you put him at the top level or the next level down?
He never made it to the top level. This stature as an actor is not a question of somebody's talents or performance or anything you can put out of yourself. You don't achieve stature as an actor. It's socially constructed. So it has to do with how you're regarded in the business and how you're marketing people in the studio system at the time of Robert Ryan actually contrived to advertise you and place you. So he was never really billed as a top actor. But I think that's one of the things we now find very sad a lot. We look at movies from the 30s, 40s, 50s, and we see people who were quite remarkable. Say Gloria Graham is quite remarkable. But she never made it as a big star. She's acting on screen at the same time as Marilyn Monroe. Monroe made it as a star. She's also remarkable. But Graham is too, and she never quite got put to the same level. So it's the way the system has to place people. There's only room for a certain number of stars in the star system.
Thank you.
Right, yeah. Thanks for the call. Other calls are welcome. 333-WILL and toll free 800-222-WILL. I do want to talk for a little bit about directors. And I'm thinking about a conversation I had at some point here on the show. There's a fellow who's in cinema studies who comes on the show every once in a while. We talk about movies and noted the fact that...
this would be Edwin Jahil.
This would be... No, not Edwin. Dave Desser.
Edwin, oh, David Desser.
Edwin, he belongs to Celeste Quinn in the Afternoon Magazine.
Well, David Desser would have a lot to say about
and Dave. Yeah. And we were talking about Martin Scorsese, about the fact that, you know, if you ask people a question like, well, who is the greatest living American film director?
Martin Scorsese.
But then he said, aha. But now, you ask people, what are your favorite films? His movies are not going to be on anybody's list of great movies.
Well, Goodfellas is on my list of top 10.
Oh, okay. Yeah. But that gets you thinking about, well, to what extent we honor directors and why, and to what extent the who the director is important, and do we really, you know, there aren't very many auteur directors anymore.
Yeah.
And there, it seems that they're as dispensable or interchangeable in a sense as the actors are, because they're also free agents.
Well, look, let me say something that many of the listeners and certainly many of my colleagues around the world would find patently outrageous. Steven Spielberg is an auteur director, and he's a major auteur director, and one that we're not paying nearly enough attention to.
All right, defend that.
There we go. An auteur director is someone who can use style and expressive technique to bring you, to engage you deeply in a film, to tell a story visually, to mobilize all of the forces of production and shape them all so that there's a kind of signal moment on screen. And there's so many of these moments in Spielberg, and so much high production value that's placed at the value of storytelling. A very quick example, E.T. the Extraterrestrial from 1982. It's a movie about a boy who discovers a funny creature in his backyard and makes a pet of him. The creature turns out to be an extraterrestrial, and there's a love story, and the extraterrestrial goes home to his planet, and the boy is touched for the rest of his life, as you might have it. Right. At the end of the film, in order for the plot to turn, there has to be a chase sequence in which the kid with the E.T. character in the front basket of his bicycle, accompanied by his buddies on their bicycles, have to outrun the federal bureaucracy in their Chevrolets or whatever they used at the time. And they're in a suburban housing tract somewhere in California with hills and houses that aren't completely built. And they're biking up and over the hills, and the cars are screaming around streets and coming to a halt and running off hilltops and falling down and all kinds of fantastic stuff with exciting John Williams music going in the background. If you look carefully, turn the sound off and just look really carefully at that sequence and watch the way the pieces of film are shot and cut, exactly what part of a car or bicycle appears at the edge of the screen and goes off, exactly where on screen to match with another piece of equipment coming in the next shot, you see that it's a symphony of movement, absolutely choreographed. And then you back off and realize how complicated it would be to set this up and shoot it. Mm-hmm. With the lighting right and the movement right and the action right and the place all set up exactly properly. Boy, that's astonishing auteur filmmaking.
Well, that's also great editing.
Yeah, I know, but it's shot to be edited in that way. And Spielberg is constructing that editing along with Michael Kahn, his editor. This is not accidental. Hmm. So, I mean, that's just one of many, 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 many examples you could pick out of Spielberg. I mean, the scene in Empire of the Sun when the kid goes down the hill and finds the old Japanese fighter and gets into it. The camera swoops in to his face behind the glass pane in the cockpit so that we have a sense of the emotional rush that the kid is having as he's sitting there. You know, we have that exact rush as we swoop into his presence. I think that's very melodramatic and it's very powerful.
Hmm. And you think that he's regarded as an important director in his films and make a lot of money.
Well, I think that's why no one talks about him.
So you can't somehow in the minds of people who think they're serious about film making money and art are not.
Absolutely.
You can't go together.
No, I have to hurry to give my Johnny Depp talks now before he gets to be any more famous than he is, because he's getting too rich. Nobody wants to take him seriously. And this is just really a shame. It's really a shame. It's resentment, and the resentment doesn't have any role. Spielberg is successful because he's approaching a very large number of people with his message, and they're reading it. One of the reasons also that I think he's not thought of as an auteur is because the auteur is frequently considered to be a filmmaker or artist who has a single message or a single vision, and it keeps being repeated from film to film. You know, Scorsese is often seen as a guy who's talking about morality in the streets, mm-hmm. for example. And with Spielberg, whose filmmaking is in many ways as crazy as Johnny Depp's acting. I mean, he goes from one crazy project to another. It's hard to figure out if there's a solid single set of themes there, and maybe that's one reason people don't take him seriously.
Yeah. Are there other directors that you would put in that same category who are they may be successful and they may be well thought of and their movies make a lot of money, but who are underappreciated for the level of art of their direction?
Sidney Lumet, I would say, is a very important filmmaker. He's not really doing much work now. He's probably retired mostly, but he'd made some fantastic films. You're thinking about current living young directors, yeah. Not Quentin Tarantino. A fountainhead of style. Style to burn. Warehouse of style bigger than many, many other people, but nothing to say with the style. It's all style.
Yeah. And it seems to me to be pretty much all stolen also. I mean, he's got to be one of the most derivative directors ever because it's all grabbed from other places.
It's graduate student syndrome, you know. Yeah. He's had to read a lot of footnotes, and so he's afraid to actually open his mouth and say anything without quoting somebody.
Mm-hmm. We have, let me see, about 3, 4, or 5 minutes left. Somebody wants to call in real quick. We can get in a comment. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. What just in terms of trends in American film, is there something that you think is particularly interesting or particularly disturbing?
There's a new form of narrative that I'm finding on screen kind of interesting. There are a couple of trends I'm finding interesting. There's the fragment story. Magnolia is one example of it. Shortcuts is another example of it. Robert Altman's film in the Gosford Park is another example of it, where you have a large number of characters, but instead of being amassed together, as in the old disaster movies, you know, where a plane would crash or a building would go on fire. All the stars are in the top of the building.
Right.
Here, they're in groups of two or three running off on their own little stories. And one of the most recent well-recognized examples of this was Crash, the new film made in Los Angeles, where you have a lot of different characters, but they only play together in groups of two or three. And then finally, there seems to be a pattern where something comes together at the end. So I'm finding that interesting because it's a way of trying to marshal small script resources into a big film. I mean, you have a bunch of little vignettes is what you have, and then somebody kind of stitches the vignettes into a quilt. So maybe a way to talk about this is quilt film. So quilt film is new, and I think it's going to expand. It's a way to employ a lot of actors, but not to have to pay any of them a lot of money because they do 2-3 days' work. So you don't have a main star. There's no Jack Nicholson at $1 million a day there for 30 days kind of thing. Mm. And then there are a lot of films about watching. You might want to call these surveillance films. Films in which what's actually going on screen is that we get to watch a character either watching a TV screen or watching a computer screen or watching another movie screen. So they're films about the act of watching a screen image. Often it has to do with a heist or a robbery or some kind of spy system. There's a pretext for it. But the imagery we're being thrown is imagery about ourselves sitting and watching and decoding the screen.
Let's talk with one more caller
Sure.
here in the time that is left. In Champaign, line one.
Hi. I was wondering if you know of any film projects that Johnny Depp may have turned down that you would have liked to have seen him actually pursue.
No. What a great question. What a depressing answer. I'll tell you something I'm a little depressed to know about that he might not turn down. Would that please you?
Okay.
The rights have been bought to the story of a man named Khadra, who's an Arab terrorist, so that Johnny Depp can play that role.
Hmm.
It's not yet determined whether he will, but there's obviously been discussion. I think that would be fascinating and shocking and deeply problematic for his career. But he has all along done things that are problematic for his career.
Yeah, it seems that way. But, you know, they seem to have been good choices when it came down to
That's
it.
That's right.
And, you know, he does have a kind of a matinee idol look. You know, I guess some of the quirkiness of some of his roles don't always show it. But I think from the woman's perspective, he is kind of a hottie, too. So he has that going for him as well as his talent.
Let me ask you, isn't it kind of intriguing that this guy who does have the matinee idol look, you might say the sort of young Tab Hunter. I mean, he's not blonde like Tab Hunter, but he's got that stunning good looks. There are a lot of women who just go on about how beautiful he is. That he would do something like Willy Wonka or Captain Jack Sparrow, where he's so made up and so kinky looking. I mean, don't you find that fascinating?
Yes, but, you know, ever since he did Edward Scissorhands, I mean, he does it so well. That's one thing I like about him.
With Edward Scissorhands, he was completely hidden. And with Willy Wonka, I mean, you're looking at the lipstick.
Yeah, true, but still, well, yeah, I see what you're saying, but I think that the kind of kinkiness come through in Willy Wonka, too. He looks kind of weird.
He does look kind of weird. I mean, he doesn't, if you were to take somebody from another culture who miraculously hadn't heard about Johnny Depp yet, or if you found a Martian or something, or some young person who hadn't realized who he was, and you said, now, this is a matinee idol, I think they'd find that really strange.
Well, I don't know. I can kind of see through it in a different way. Maybe in that kind of a John Barrymore kind of way, you know, where sometimes he could come across looking kind of strange, too. But, you know, he was supposed to be the man.
Well, I wonder whether you and a lot of other people who watch Johnny Depp and find him fascinating are actually looking at the movies as a cover for magazine illustrations and newspaper illustrations that are underneath and that are showing you the actor not made up. So that you're actually seeing both images at once.
Maybe. That's a point. I have to think about it.
You know, if you look at a movie like, I'm trying to think of a movie where Johnny Depp looks like Johnny Depp. Say a little bit to What's Eating Gilbert Grape.
Right.
His hair's a little bit long there, but he does kind of look like Johnny Depp. So when you look at Willy Wonka, are you seeing a shadow of Gilbert Grape in the background? That's who you think is really there. You know, and he got dressed and he put the makeup on and he's wearing the funny hat. But underneath all that, he's Gilbert Grape, kind of.
I don't know. I would have seen it more as that, what was that? The chocolate. The more
chocolate,
like that.
Yeah.
He was kind of exotic looking. That's what it is. More exotic looking, you know. But I think he's probably exotic in his own way. You know, it's just, he's just got a look about him to me. What do you think about, what's his name? The guy that played Howard Hughes.
Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yeah, you know, I think he's really coming into his own. I was really surprised because he was kind of one of those people that I had that comment about, you know, what is the big deal here?
Well, this is a story in the making, so we have to wait a little bit.
Yeah.
He started out with an astonishing screen career. His performance in Gilbert Grape was so overwhelming that a lot of people didn't believe it was actually an actor. Mm-hmm. And I remember I have a friend who's a filmmaker. And I went to see Gilbert Grape, and the minute it was over, I phoned him up and said, there's a kid named Leonardo DiCaprio, and I spelled his name. I said, get him. And my friend didn't get him. And he's kicking himself to this day, because I thought that was an astonishing presence. And then he went and did Titanic, and that was it. That was it for that acting career. You know. So now, with the performance of Howard Hughes, it's entirely possible that he's coming back to screen acting again. We're going to have to wait and see, because I thought in The Aviator he didn't quite go all the way except in certain moments.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think there's something big coming there.
Maybe. Maybe. Well, maybe when he gets a little older and loses that baby fatty.
We are going to have to leave it there because we've come to the end of the time here for Focus 580. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, however, our guests for this morning, Murray Pomerantz, will be talking some more about Johnny Depp. He'll be giving a talk that's co-sponsored by his visit here is co-sponsored by the Unit for Cinema Studies and the folks in the Illinois Program for Research in the Humanities. 4 o'clock this afternoon at the auditorium there at the Illinois Program for Research in the Humanities. It's free and open to the public. And if you'd like to read about Johnny Depp, you can look for his book, Johnny Depp Starts Here. It's published by the Rutgers University Press.
I'm going to be signing those tonight, actually, at the Illini
Union
Bookstore and then at Pages for All Ages.
Okay, very good. Murray Pomerantz, professor of sociology at Ryerson University in Toronto, Canada. Thanks very much.
Thank you, David, very much.
Focus 580, our show made possible by Grant from Bodywork Associates, this year celebrating their 23rd anniversary. Bodywork has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Support also comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium in Urbana. On Sunday, October 23rd, from 7 to 10, the Corkscrew is hosting a concert at Farron's Pub and Eatery in Champaign to benefit local organizations dealing with displaced families from the recent Gulf hurricanes. A national indie recording artist, Sam Schaber and Ann Heaton will perform. Information available at 337-7704. Also very important to this station and its future is You, as a matter of fact, you folks who are listening right now, if you're not financial supporters, we hope that you'll get on board right now and call us at 244-9455 and make a pledge. Jack Brighton, our guy who oversees our web operations, is here. And in Pledge Central, the program director for WILO-TV, Dave Teal.
We just have about a minute left, Dave. How are we doing on that challenge? We're trying to get to new people, people who have never pledged before, to call in with a pledge, 244-9455. And if you do that, then another listener will kick in an additional $25 for every pledge. How are we doing, Dave?
Well, yeah, actually, we haven't been hearing from new people. We've been hearing from people who are either current members or returning members, and that's great. We're certainly happy to have them continue to be on board, but we really need to hear if you have not made a pledge before and you value this program, you listen every morning, maybe you call in and ask a question. We want you to call in right now at 244-9455. Put your money where your mouth is and help us to meet some of these challenges.
Well, big challenges. We're trying to get to $70,000 by the end of today, and that's so we can reach our year-end fundraising goal of, well, close to $1 million for the station. So we hope that you will contribute right now by calling 244-9455. Become a member of the Friends of WILL.
We just want to make sure that people understand, you know, however you contribute, the important thing is that we can count you as a contributor, a member of this group we call the Friends of WILL. These are the folks that support us with the financial contributions. And we can't stress enough how important it is because, you know, those other sources, the state funds, the federal funds, they continue to go down. And the only way that we can make up the difference and try to keep the same level of quality, and we hope even over time to increase that level of quality, is if listeners will do their bit. 47% of the money that it takes to run to the station comes from listeners, and we want you to be one of them. 244-9455, and if you'd like to pledge online, go to willpledge.org. Well, thank you, Jack and Dave, and we're going to have to make way here for the Afternoon Magazine. There'll be news and sports and weather throughout the rest of the afternoon. The host for the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we will talk with Melanie Rahek. She is the author of Girl Sleuth. It's all about Nancy Drew. The first Nancy Drew mystery appeared in 1930. 80 million books later, she's still going strong. She's an American icon. We'll talk about Nancy Drew this afternoon in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine. Let's take a look at what's happening on the Chicago Board of Trade. December wheat is trading at 327 and a quarter, down 1.5. March, 341 and a quarter, down 2.25. December corn, 201 and a quarter, down 3/4. March, 214 and a quarter, down 1/2. May, 222 and a quarter, down 1/4. December corn, 247 and a quarter, up 1/4. November soybeans, 587 and a half, that up 3. January beans trading at 599, up 2 1/4. March, 607, that up 3. December meal, 172 even, up $1. December oil, 2435.